Coming from the Lower Haight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. All right, welcome once again. It's the Are You Serious Show. I think I've just about lost count of the number of shows that we've done. There have been so many of them. It's been dragging on for so long. How do I get out of this radio thing that I started? I don't know how, but I'm pleased to be here, and I'm pleased as punch that we're going to be running the second part of our interview with that firecracker philosopher, that wild young thing, Richard Rorty, well-known philosopher from Stanford University, recently retired. We've got a great gang of four here, the traditional number when you're talking about gangs of, a gang of four. As usual, Jeff Deal is here, and Diana Brown is back with us, and my man Will Block, who you all just listened to. Those of you who are smart enough to tune into Neophiles as well as the Are You Serious show, you all just listened to him. So we got four of us here today.
Woo.
And welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
Welcome, Will.
You're welcome.
I am, and welcome to you, Diana.
Thank you, Are You. I want to tell you, being here with just the three of you is a welcome relief. The hordes of paparazzi outside my flat, the people coming up to me on the street, the endless emails, 7,412, why 12? Emails trying to use me to get to you.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up.
Today's the first day of the rest of your life, baby. Or the last day. Whoa.
7 years of war, famine, disease, natural disasters, and eventually the end of the world.
Serious.
I know, it's rough. Those paparazzi are rough. You know, I've built a big bunker.
Must be nice. You and Chaney, huh?
I'm down there with my dog and lots of guns.
Jeff, you feel me, don't you? You deal with this on a daily basis.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm trying to cultivate kind of a different relationship to the paparazzi, patterned after Jessica Alba and her ass.
Nice.
Oh, that's a nice pattern to follow.
I know, exactly. Yeah. I always follow that. But yeah, you'll notice that she, you know, if she knows there are paparazzi in the bushes, she doesn't try to control them or hide. No, she gets on all fours and sticks her ass up in the air as far as it'll go.
And this is working for you.
What?
And that's what you've been doing?
I've been in the bushes.
Offering your butt to the paparazzi?
Not so much actually giving it, but ready. Ready.
No. Because this throws them off guard. In fact, it throws the entire pop culture off guard. They don't know what to do with these photos of her ass sticking way up in the air, you know? It's like, well, she's indulging us. What do we do? We can't really publish these photos as well as we can the other ones. So they end up on the internet, of course, but they can't go into the tabloids. So, yeah, I'm actually...
So they're not making money off of them.
Oh, well, I don't know. Somebody's probably making some money somehow, but not in the traditional sense, like of going into the Inquirer or
the ones that are on the... How counterculture of you.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to...
is dying to follow Jessica Alba's... but
who knew that?
New permutations.
I think maybe she has a whole new audience out there that she was unaware
of. Well, that's exactly the wonderful thing about being hip or being cool, is that it really can embrace anything. Any superficiality, you can turn it into something that is somehow transmissible, and being able to be worn as a badge.
An iconic talisman of coolness.
Yeah.
Even offering your butt up to the paparazzi.
Yeah, if we got a picture.
Even if the paparazzi doesn't want your butt.
Whether your paparazzi wants it or not.
Yeah.
If we could get a picture of your butt up in the air and put it on a button.
A button.
And get Jessica Alba to authorize it, to, you know, pitch it, we could make a million.
Yeah, I think we're on the verge of something really important here.
What do you think?
I think it's a good idea. I happened to see Jessica Alba just yesterday. I saw
where?
her latest film, Into the Blue.
Into the Blue.
And
at the premiere,
and she was not a premiere, but she was displaying a marvelous suntan.
And practicing her
posturing, you know, which is
she was hella great.
Even underwater is really amazing.
What was that TV show? The James Cameron TV show,
Dark Angel.
Dark Angel.
As Steve Robles used to call it, Dark Anal.
lovely show. That was a good one.
That was a good one. That was her. That was her coming out. That was brilliant for that too.
Well, my favorite Jessica Alba is the dance sequence from Sin City. She's absolutely spectacular.
Yeah. I still haven't gotten around to.
I appreciate the respite with the Alba, but we still have the problem of the paparazzi trying to use me to get to RU.
Well, I think
just have a press conference.
Just throw them my way.
Just give them his phone number, his address.
I'll present my.
They want articles of clothing that I can give them to sell on eBay.
You know, I don't have any clothing.
A lock of hair.
I'm a counterculture person. I don't wear any clothing.
It's true. He's stark naked right now. And believe me, I am just trying to look down.
I have
nothing. He isn't cute.
I have nothing but a loincloth.
But it wears a designer label.
We're here once again with Richard Rorty. Thanks for coming back and joining us.
Thanks for asking me.
Richard Rorty is, of course, a distinguished philosopher, former Stanford professor, author of many books and articles and so forth. So, Richard, you've been around for a while. You're now a retired. You've observed popular culture over the years, I'm sure. How do you cope with popular mediated culture like reality TV and, you know, the popularity of Paris Hilton and that sort of thing? Is that
actually I don't think I've ever had much contact with popular culture.
So you just stay away from it.
Paris Hilton.
Yeah. I've lived in an ivory tower.
Oh, okay. Do you think there might be something there to be valued or to be found? I mean, people teach courses in Madonna and The Simpsons. And
You could fool me. I watch old movies on TV, but that's about it. Yeah. And Law and Order and West Wing. But.
So, I mean, your philosophical resonances in a sense or predecessors, does it start with Nietzsche or...
Well, mainly James and Dewey.
Yeah. And how would you describe, what is the influence of Henry James? Most people wouldn't.
Henry was the novelist. William James is the philosopher, brother. But, I mean, they're both equally good. But my business is mostly with William.
How would you describe his influence?
He was inspired by Emerson to say, don't look for reality, look for freedom and imagination. Dewey picked up on this line. You can think of both Nietzsche and William James as disciples of Emerson. Think of Emerson as the founding figure of a philosophical tradition.
When you say Emerson, you're talking about
Ralph
Waldo Emerson, the transcendentalist.
Yeah.
If you look to Emerson, is there a spiritual or religious aspect that you see? Because the transcendentalists took notions of God and sort of handed it down to the individual so that they would have personal contact with something that was like the divine. Do you look for, is there a divinity that you look to, a sense of divinity?
Emerson pretty much identified divinity with the human poetic imagination. He wasn't interested in an immaterial, otherworldly deity, much less a deity with who made providential arrangements for human beings. And remember that Emerson quit the Unitarian church, and sort of walked out on organized religion.
But there is a sense of nature or being in the universe as a source of inspiration.
There's a kind of Wordsworthian pantheism that pops up occasionally in Emerson, but I don't think that's the interesting part.
Okay, so leading from Emerson, what Emerson did for you then, for your philosophy, was get you away from or move philosophy away from systemic thought and into the area of imagination. And
he helped say philosophy should pay less attention to the sciences and more to art and literature. Don't think of mathematics and physics as human beings at their best. Think of prophecy and poetry as human beings at their best. But before Emerson, philosophy for 200 years had concentrated on coming to terms with the new science of Galileo and Newton. And Emerson was one of the first figures to say, forget physics, forget mathematics. That's not really important. He was echoing Blake.
Right. He was listening to an inner voice.
Yeah, you can put it that way, but I think it would be better to say hoping that people would achieve their own voice rather than listening for anything inside or outside.
So do you feel as people express themselves through their imagination and arrive at a sense of themselves and so on, does that lead them to any place in particular, or are you content to have that be the end in itself?
I'm content to let it be the end in an end in itself. Emerson has an essay called Circles in which he says the whole point of being a human being is to draw a circle around everything that has been known in the past, everything that has been said in the past, encompass it all with something within something larger. And his picture is of a process that couldn't possibly end. As long as there are human beings, there will be larger and larger circles indefinitely. And the circle shouldn't be conceived of as getting closer to something already in existence, but as making stuff up.
So it's the opposite of an onion, right?
Yeah.
That you peel off.
Yeah.
You just, so do you yourself feel that there is one universe, in a sense, that we're all part of it, but like in enlarging those circles, we never reach the limit. We never know what the whole thing is. You're not capable of really knowing the whole.
I don't think there is a thing that the whole thing is. There's just a cloud of elementary physical particles stretched out through space, which by accident organized themselves into life at one point and then into intelligent life into another point. And then you got, as a consequence of the creation of the coming into existence of intelligent life, you got the history of human culture. Whatever progress human beings make, it has nothing to do with that vast expanse of interacting physical particles. That's the only candidate I can think of for the whole. And who cares about the interacting physical particles?
Brothers and sisters, I come here today to ask you one question.
Here comes the question.
Everyone, please, bow your heads and pretend to be serious.
Do it or I'll bow them for you.
Here comes the question.
Don't worry. World, global, universal, and cosmological rights reserved. Mineral rights, too.
Copyright, all rights reserved.
Protected by an electric fence and copyright control.
Protected under copyright.
All rights reserved.
All material protected under copyright. All rights reserved.
All that we say and do is right.
Now do you understand?
And our culture has advanced beyond all that you can possibly comprehend with 100% of your brain.
Oh, is that so? And what's so advanced about it?
I'm about to see one more copyright nightmare for the music industry.
We do whatever we want to whomever we want at all times. We don't listen to people who don't like us.
Get it.
We have advanced beyond rules and manners.
Indeed.
Do you understand?
This is our concern, dude.
No, man, nothing is fucked here.
Nothing is fucked?
No, man. Has it ever occurred to you that instead of
you know, running around blaming me, you know, given the nature of all this new shit, you know, this could be a lot more complex. I mean, it's not just, it might not be just such a simple, you know?
Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. Condolences. My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir.
Kickboy have a lot of enemies?
I should hope so. Otherwise, I'm wasting my fucking time. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, to be pleasant and just have everybody say, what a pal, what a great guy, you know? I mean, I'm not using all this fucking hatred and contempt, you know, as a style. Because I don't have a style.
The major advances in civilization are processes that all but wreck the societies in which they occur.
Even if they get pissed off, they have a joint and they talk about it instead of doing something about it. They gotta do something with their time, and yeah, it's the most fun. So. Nothing else is going on. It's the only form of revolution left.
You know, we're not all grooving on the same vibes anymore. Everybody's grooving on different vibes.
I just think that it's rock and roll. That's what it is.
What do you like about it?
Well, I like that it's like, it's something new, and it's just reviving like old rock and roll, and it's like it's raw again, and it's for real, and it's fun, you know. It's like, it's not bullshit, there's no rock stars there.
You see all this potential, and I see it squandered. God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables. Slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes. Working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. We're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war. No great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression. All been raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We're slowly learning that fact. We're very, very pissed off.
Pleasure, the inevitable byproduct of our civilization. Tragedy of your times, my young friends, is that you may get exactly what you want.
What do you get with freedom? Excesses, exploitation, of course. And what does one say to that? A small price to pay. If you don't like it, don't listen to it, don't read it, don't watch it. Without free communication, you don't have a free society. Democracy is based on it.
Another guest we interviewed talked about the sort of the coming together of biological and a kind of mechanistic evolution of people and machines, would you say, or whatever, sort of blending
synthesis,
yeah,
really,
into a new kind of being. Do you think there's room in that kind of scenario for the continuation of that process of the imagination?
I don't see that anything interesting is going to happen in the way of developments in cognitive science, computer science, biology, or anything else giving us a new sense of who we are, we can mechanize various biological processes. This is happening in microbiology and will happen more when we develop nanotechnology, but it won't give us a new picture of who we are. It'll just give us a more detailed picture of how we work.
So really your philosophy, if you will, is of a great humanness and human creativity and human potential and imagination, right? That's the thing that you believe in, if you will.
Yeah, I'm not entirely happy with saying it's something I believe in. I mean, I admire imaginative people, people who draw larger circles, make things new. But I don't think there's a general phenomenon called, you know, the human imagination to which one should stand in awe. I mean, imagination doesn't really signify anything except the ability to produce useful novelties.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the word taken as a whole concept, it's kind of fights against itself in some way when you repeat it. Should we break for a second and then come back?
I can probably squeeze this in. We're doing okay. My mind tends to go back when I think about some of the themes in your writing, like authenticity and Kant and things like this. I always come back to the desire to influence. It seems to be something that always pops up into my head, and it can be applied to, you know, the scientist who's doing research and trying to uncover some larger, you know, process, or it can be applied to an artist who's creating imaginative works and wants to, you know, get that into the minds of other people. It can be applied to philosophers and professors, obviously, who are standing in front of classrooms. Do you have any thoughts on that? That kernel of an idea that the desire to influence, is that somehow primary, or where does it fit in?
No, I think it's just, you know, an extra added benefit. And people like Newton and Einstein, who imaginatively transformed our picture of the physical universe, or people like Blake and Emerson, who transformed our notion of the relation between art and science, weren't saying, gee, how can I be influential? They were in business for themselves. As it happened, they were influential because the stuff caught on.
Yeah, I mean, Emerson did go out and give influential and controversial talks, and, you know, I mean,
that was how he made his living.
That's always a factor, too.
I guess that's what I mean, though, that by doing it for yourself, you're answering that desire that's within you to influence, whether it's one person that you're talking to or an imagined population of people that might get your message. There's always that initial drive to reconfigure something and make it make sense to someone else.
Well, can I speak to that? I've been a painter all my life, and as an artist, I think the impulse is to make the thing, or if you're a writer or a philosopher, make your statement. And you may or may not have some option to want to influence people. I never have that. And
it just seems like
the purpose
of making a statement presupposes the desire to
influence. No, it's more, it's expressing yourself.
Well, communication means influence, doesn't it? I mean, by its very
not
nature.
Always.
But Blake and Van Gogh weren't particularly interested in communication or influence. As Sherry says, they were influenced in making something that had never existed before. Right. And the question of whether anybody was ever going to pay any attention was secondary.
That's pretty rare, though, I would think. I mean, Emerson, somebody like Emerson or Wittgenstein, I mean, they were writing so that people would read.
Not in Wittgenstein's case,
really?
No.
Yeah.
Well, it seems difficult to know that, though. I mean, like, you can read their writings, and if they don't mention the desire to influence, then you could say they that's not what they're after. But if you imagine on a psychological level, I just extrapolate from my own, you know, because I'm solipsist, I guess, but that they must have, on some personal level, before they even picked up a pen or started down a train of thought, they had this desire to, like, I'm going to take what's given and I'm going to change it. Somehow that's going to have meaning, and that, you know what I mean? I mean, that meaning seems to suggest the desire or the need to...
Well, there are two sides of that. If you look in yourself and you're lucky enough to identify your own unique characteristics, and say, I'm going to express myself of who as what I am and who I am, that makes the creation of a book or a
yeah, there's one can take an enormous amount of satisfaction in getting it down on the canvas or the you know, typing it out on the page without the question of who's ever going to look at this stuff arising in your mind, I think. I mean, you may be right that deep down somewhere there's the need to be admired and the need to be influential, but I doubt that it I doubt that thinking of us that way helps much.
What about, I mean, in your own case as a philosophical speaker and writer, did you feel that you had a, at any point, had a message that you were trying to get out to people, or were you resolving your own thinking by getting it on paper?
It was never a matter of getting a message out to people. It was a matter of arguing with my fellow philosophers, which is different. I mean, it's, you know, it's an activity you get into if you teach in the humanities. You conduct controversies with your colleagues, and your attention isn't to the public. It's to what Jones is going to say in response to your criticism of his last article.
You know. In my view, that counts just as much, though.
Right. It's a smaller circle.
Yeah.
It's inside baseball to some extent. Yeah. But,
well, of course, it's nice if people say, hey, you were right, but this almost never happens in philosophy.
Never happens to me.
Do you have followers? Do you have... Are there followers?
No, not to speak of. I mean, there are some people I've taught, and their books sort of hang together with mine as part of a general train of thought, but that's not exactly having followers.
I mean, is this train of thought still called pragmatism? I mean, and when I looked you up, everybody said influential. So apparently, whether that's a primary motivation or not, that seems to be... out there that you have had influence.
I think influence is so unpredictable that it's not something you can really aim for.
Well, what would the influence be, I guess? What would be the influence of your philosophy? I mean, does pragmatism come down to being about politics, about how you handle politics?
No, it's 9/10 of it is a matter of fairly technical controversies that... Right. People outside of
it's
philosophy
not pragmatism
don't have any,
as we understand it.
No, it has a special philosophical sense.
Description.
Well, as I said before, it centers around refusing to think of truth as accurate representation of reality.
But that's what I see, though. That's what I understood that you did, and I see that as a tremendous contribution because there's still so many people in very different environments who espouse a rigid system, whether it's philosophical or religious or religious or whatever. And I think that your voice in that one, even that one statement, is unique, and your influence is.
I don't think
that you're breaking that. You're allowing an alternative. You made a field. I was picturing a real field, but a field of thought that people can go in comfortably and not feel that they have to have a system that is very concrete.
Well, people who take philosophy courses don't come into them with rigid systems. They come into them precisely because they're open to suggestion. Mm-hmm. So philosophy teachers have it easy because... The people we encounter don't have rigid systems. They're looking for something.
But I mean, outside of your talk about circles, you can say, okay, that's your professional circle, students and other professors. But other people in a wider context look at you and look at your work, and we are able to say, this is a wonderful option that I can think for myself and create myself and not take a form of life that I'm inheriting from either a philosophy or a religion or whatever, political party, anything. So you've offered that option out into the world. You're too modest.
Well, I've tried to popularize various people who did that, but I wouldn't think of myself as adding anything particularly
original. But that's
original.
Just because you're modest.
Don't feel like you've originated point of view.
Yeah, I think basically I just put other people's stuff together in patterns.
That's what I try to do myself, actually. I want to ask one more question, and this goes back again to the essay that I read about the importance of the novel, which was based on the work of Bloom. And most of your references seem to be to older novels. Are there any contemporary novelists that you would commend to people? Or if not, what novelists would you commend to people?
I wrote a review of Ian McEwan's Saturday recently, which I thought was very impressive. I just finished Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, which is very different than McEwan, but also impressive. Those are the two people whom I admire at the moment, but I tend to have different favorite novelists every year.
Uh-huh. And do those novels do what you were looking for in a novel, or what you're claiming might be available from a novel in some of your philosophic essays?
Well, novels do so many different things, it's hard to say there's a specific task, but McEwan makes the situation of, you know, the bourgeoisie in a West that's under attack and is in decline very vivid. Ishiguro writes an allegory of the exploitation of human beings by other human beings that's very powerful. Mm-hmm. They're different kinds of novelists than James or Proust, who I guess are my great heroes among novelists, but they're very good at what they do.
I want to thank you once again, Richard Wardy, for coming in and joining us here on the Are You Serious show. Hope to talk to you again sometime. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting
me.
Thank you.
Are you serious?
We'd like to thank Richard Rorty for joining us on the show today. Our gang of three, once again, was Are You Serious, Diana Brown, and me, Jeff Deal. Next week, our guests will be the authors of Why Do Men Have Nipples? Mark Lehner and Billy Goldberg. The Are You Serious show is part of the Mondo Globo Network. Subscribe to all of our shows at mondoglobo.net. Thanks for listening, and don't be afraid of the dark.